From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now, and we'll start this hour at the Supreme Court, which today upheld Michigan's voter-approved ban on affirmative action in college admissions.
The justices ruled 6-2 in favor of maintaining the ban, which had been struck down by a lower court. Seven other states have similar voter-approved bans. It's thought this ruling could encourage other states to pass their own. Let's bring in Emily Bazelon, Slate Legal Affairs Editor. And Emily, I want to be clear about this because there have been other Supreme Court cases taking up the issue of affirmative action. This is not a decision about whether schools can have affirmative action, whether having that discriminates against whites. That was a recent case. This is a decision about whether a state can have a ban, whether that discriminates against minorities. And the court apparently decided it doesn't discriminate. States can have bans.
Exactly. So this is the flip side of the Supreme Court affirmative action case we've gotten used to over the years. The previous cases were cases in which a white student would challenge the constitutionality of a racially based preference that the school and the state wanted to give. What happened here is the opposite. The state of Michigan, the voters in 2006 voted to ban race-based preferences in college and university admissions. And so the question for the court was, did the voters have the power to enact this ban? And yes, they approved the voters' decision.
And what was their reasoning, those who voted yes?
Those who voted yes are very much in favor of settling this question through the democratic process. So they were arguing that this is really just a case not about what kind of affirmative action policy to have, but about who gets to decide that. And they said if the voters don't want to have explicit race-based preferences, then that's a decision the voters can make without unconstitutionally discriminating against minorities.
Well, and of course, the argument on the other side is that putting issues like race to a vote is a tender topic. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor dissented, and Justice Sotomayor did so vigorously. She wrote a 58-page dissent and read part of it from the bench. She herself is someone who has benefited from affirmative action. What did she have to say?
Well, she is very concerned that what the court is doing here is stigmatizing race-based preferences and making them seem as if they are bad for society and ignoring all the good that they've done over the years for African-Americans and Latinos. And so Sotomayor wanted to be really clear that she does not think this is a decision that should be left in the hands of the voters. And there have been past cases in which the court has been concerned about the rights of minorities at the hands of majority voters. And so she was invoking those older decisions.
But as you've said, this is a court, this is the John Roberts Court. He's a Chief Justice, and he's made it clear that he wants to steer the court toward a colorblind approach.
Exactly. And he wrote a very brief concurring opinion in which he took Sotomayor to task. She was saying that race matters because of the message of I do not belong here, which I think is familiar to a lot of minorities. Roberts said, wait a second, it's not out of touch with reality to conclude that racial preferences may themselves be reinforcing exactly that feeling of doubt and may do more harm than good. So he's having really a kind of discussion about the morality and the benefits of affirmative action with Justice Sotomayor.
Well, it's interesting because there's such history in Michigan. Michigan long a battleground when it comes to affirmative action. 10 years ago, under a different Supreme Court, two rulings regarding the University of Michigan. One struck down the undergraduate school's use of a point system that included race in deciding admissions. It was part of the points that were added up. The other decision, though, by that Supreme Court upheld the law school's consideration of race, among other factors. So this new decision today, in effect, is overturning a previous Supreme Court's decision, at least when it told the University of Michigan 10 years ago that the law school could consider race.
Right. Well, this is a decision that's upholding the preferences of the voters who themselves kind of rebelled against the law school's admissions policy. That's probably the way to think about it. And, you know, when you think of the legacy here, there's just this question of at selective schools, there are these very coveted, limited number of spots. And how do we decide who gets them? And the voters in Michigan don't want race to be explicitly a part of that process. I think it is important to point out that since this ban went into effect at the University of Michigan, minority enrollment has dropped. So there has been a real effect on the chances of minority students to go to the University University of Michigan because of this policy.
In fact, we're reading in Bloomberg that black enrollment is down about 30% in undergrad and law schools since the measure took effect. That's according to the university. But Emily Bazelon, you have some thoughts for liberals, people who are very much in favor of affirmative action, who might immediately think, one would think, that this would open the floodgates, that states are now going to put this to vote and more states are going to ban affirmative action. You say what?
Well, my more hopeful take on this for liberals is that in the 8 states that have these bans, there has been an effort to reach out to minority students and low-income students in other ways. And so while it hasn't worked for keeping up black enrollment at the University of Michigan, in several other states, the flagship universities are actually doing quite well in recruiting minority students, and they're recruiting many more poor students than selective colleges generally do. I'm someone who worries a lot about income as that we don't have enough low-income students going to these schools, that they're highly attractive qualified candidates who just don't think to apply.
Of any race.
Research.
Of any
yes,
race.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Of any race. But because there are more poor black and Latino students, you can end up benefiting a lot of black and Latino kids by reaching out to poor students. So my hope is that if you explicitly ban race-based preferences, that enough schools will come up with other ways that you'll still be recruiting some of those kids and you'll get more poor students.
And just quickly, Emily, do you think other race-based questions will be put before voters given this decision?
I do think this decision will encourage other states to think about these kinds of bans because now they're clearly legal and that could attract the voters in other states.
Slate Legal Affairs editor Emily Bazelon, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it remains to be seen whether affirmative action becomes an issue in this year's congressional elections, which are just about 6.5 months from now. And the conventional wisdom is that Republicans are poised to increase their power in Washington. The GOP is also targeting several state legislatures for takeover this year, including Kentucky, where Republicans are hoping to win a majority in the state House of Representatives, which is currently controlled by Democrats. There is a different battle brewing in the state's Republican-run Senate about whether Kentucky is ready for its first Muslim lawmaker. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Jonathan Meter of Kentucky Public Radio reports.
A man with a foreign accent, Muslim name, walks into Kentucky State Capitol, files his application. Nobody says, oh, you can't do that.
That's Sadiq Malik, a Democrat running for Kentucky's 36th senatorial district, reminiscing about filing his election papers earlier this year.
In my country of my birth, if a non-Muslim had walked into the election office and filed his or her papers for the office of president or prime minister or something, they would have arrested him for breaking the law.
If elected, Malik would become the first practicing Muslim elected to Kentucky's General Assembly. Malik immigrated from Pakistan more than 40 years ago. He bounced around Canada and the Midwest until settling in Louisville. Now, he's 2 courses shy of a master's degree and is putting the finishing touches on his thesis about Muslim subculture in America. Malik's father inspired him at an early age with stories of America's icons, including one from Kentucky.
And the word Lincoln was a trigger for him. You say, with Lincoln around him, that he'll forget everything he was talking about or doing. He just start talking about Lincoln and America. So you had to be careful around him. Don't utter the word Lincoln.
Muslims are a minority in America, and in Kentucky, with a population of about 11,000, their presence is nearly non-existent in elected government.
The Muslim community particularly cannot remain silent, must be engaged in the political process, must get involved. We must come together with other people in the community to talk about the importance of civil and human rights in this period of time in which our rights have been so fragile.
That's Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison in 2006, after becoming the first practicing Muslim elected to the U.S. Congress. He's since been joined by Andrew Carson of Indiana. Malik echoes Ellison's sentiment, and he hopes his candidacy will dispel rumors about Muslims in general.
Bigots and racists, no place on earth is free of them. But America is lucky that majority of the people, vast majority, does not believe in those stupid ideas. And personally, I have not experienced it.
Since 9/11, those rumors have run rampant and have even influenced policy. A handful of states have passed laws aimed at curbing a perceived Islamic infiltration of government. In Kentucky, GOP Representative Kim King has filed legislation that would prohibit Kentucky's courts from basing their decisions on foreign law, including the Muslim Sharia.
In New York State and in Michigan State, judges are deciding court cases based on foreign law, European law, Middle Eastern law, but not citing U.S. law. And it hasn't been a problem in Kentucky yet, but I want to make sure that we continue to use U.S. law to determine court cases in Kentucky.
But Malik has other problems, too. Name recognition. The chairman of the Kentucky Democratic Party says he's never heard of Malik. Considering he will be running against a Republican incumbent in a predominantly GOP district, Malik says that that is more of a disadvantage than his personal background.
Just because a lot of Republicans in my district does not mean they dislike me because of my Muslim background. They might dislike me because I'm a Democrat.
And because his political views put him at odds with the majority of Kentucky's lawmakers. For example, he supports marriage equality, currently a hot topic in Kentucky politics due to a recent federal ruling that overturned portions of the state's 2004 constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. It's one of many views that he says strains his relationship with other Muslims.
Yes, I'm absolutely in favor of that. I have absolutely all gay marriages, gay people, they are just as human beings as you and I, they deserve equality and protection. Absolutely.
Despite the odds, Malik is optimistic he will make history.
Donald Trump is not going to come here and ask me for my birth certificate because it's in a language that he probably does not know. This will be an election campaign based on issues, and that's the way democracy works, and that's the way it's going to work in 36.
Spoken like a true American politician. For Here and Now, I'm Jonathan Meter in Frankfort, Kentucky.
The Associated Press is reporting that the Obama administration is considering changes to its deportation policies so that longtime undocumented residents of the U.S. who have no criminal records could be shielded from deportation. This comes at a time when many Hispanics are calling President Obama the deporter in chief. For more on this, we're joined by Enrique Acevedo, anchor at Univision News. He's with us from Miami. Enrique, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Happy to be back.
Well, tell us more about what kinds of changes are being proposed to the deportation policies.
It's basically this. Since President Obama took office, only 20% of over 2 million deportation cases, or around 2 million deportation cases, involve people convicted of serious crimes. So two-thirds of the nearly 2 million deported involve people who have committed minor infractions or no crimes at all. That's what they want to change, and that's what they want to focus on.
And why? Why are they doing this now?
Well, they are looking for a more humane approach towards immigrations after activists have pressured the White House to do this. For a while, people have blamed Republicans for not committing to long-term changes in our immigration system, and they're right to do so. I mean, Republicans in the House have deliberately blocked any long-term and much-needed changes to our immigration system. And Latinos are going to remember that in the polls, make no mistake about it. But now they're also asking President Obama to have a more humane approach towards deportation. This brutal enforcement of current policies that have separated hundreds of thousands of families and, you know, cost a lot to communities, to Latino communities around the country.
But if he does that, if he takes what you're calling a more humane approach, doesn't he kill any chance of getting immigration reform passed? Which, of course, yes, it doesn't look good right now for advocates of the Senate bill that did pass in the Senate getting through the House. But there's still some chance, isn't there?
Well, there's a small chance between now and the midterm elections in November. But, you know, it doesn't look like the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, is going to bring it to a vote in the House. So, you know, if we weren't able to pass immigration reform in the last 5 years when Democrats had control of Congress, when the Senate passed the bill, it doesn't look like it's going to be the case in the next 3 months. Still, the White House and President Obama say they believe that this is possible. And activists and immigration groups, like I said, also want that to happen.
You recently spotlighted a 82-year-old grandfather named Jose Guadalupe Ramos, who is living across the border in Tijuana, Mexico, after being deported. Is he the kind of immigrant who would be able to stay in the U.S. or come back to the U.S. under the policy changes that are being talked about?
Exactly that type of immigrants, what we talk about when we call for a more humane approach on immigration. I mean, we have to understand where these people come from. We have to understand in some cases they've been here for decades. They have children or grandchildren who were born in the U.S. They've never committed a crime. They're just model citizens in every way we want to look at it. So the criminalization of immigrant communities in the country has escalated at unprecedented rates, Jeremy. Just according to the Pew Hispanic Center, the increase in unlawful reentry convictions alone accounts for almost half of the growth in the total number of offenders sentenced in federal courts during the last decades. That's more than twice as much as federal convictions related to drug offenses in the same period. And we're already changing our drug policy because we don't want as many people, behind bars because of drug possession, for example. Like a damaged dam, our broken immigration system is slowly collapsing before the eyes of politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, who have not yet felt the cost of doing nothing.
We're speaking with Univision anchor Enrique Acevedo. And Enrique, there is another side to this. People who believe that everything you're saying is wrong, and they think we're being too easy as a nation on immigrants who have come into the country illegally. What about what we're hearing from Republicans like Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, who has actually proposed an amendment that would ban all undocumented immigrants from ever earning citizenship?
Well, we hear arguments like, for example, border security. Let's talk about the facts on border security. We have 21,000 armed federal agents at the border with drones, with state-of-the-art equipment, with all-terrain vehicles, helicopters, boats, whatever. They stand next to a 700-mile wall. And the only other place on Earth where we have such a presence at a border is the border between North and South Korea. And we're talking about a country here that we regard as a friend. At least that's what President Obama has called Mexico. We are complying with the law, but we're not doing it in a way that's helping our country. And that's, understanding why this is happening as an economic phenomenon, immigration, I mean. So when people like Ted Cruz talk about taking a harder stand on immigration, I would just ask Senator Ted Cruz, why is he not given the same opportunity that his parents were given when they came to this country? So America is no longer a country where immigrants are welcome, it seems, at least not those who make the journey from down south.
Well, why do you think, given all of those things that you brought up, that nothing has been done, that there wasn't a real push in both parties to pass immigration reform, especially after the last election, when a lot of the political wisdom coming out of it was that Republicans needed to get behind this bill on comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, under my logic, it doesn't make any sense that Republicans are not on board for passing immigration reform. But that has been the case. I guess you have to point to the fact that there are not immediate incentives for Republicans, especially for House Republicans, to pass immigration reform, because in most of their districts, the Hispanic population is not going to determine the outcome of an election. But if they want to go back and win the White House, it's not going to happen until they get the Latino vote. So, like we said many times, the road to the White House goes through El Barrio. Now, it's important also to point to Democrats and the White House and President Obama, because he promised to have immigration reform passed. And he has, tried to do so in Congress, not when he had control, not when Democrats had control of Congress, but since he has tried to do that. And the Senate passed the bill. But I would argue that both Republicans and the White House are equally responsible for the status quo at this point.
Really? You think, but Republicans and the White House, because the White House has, of course, come out and said, we want immigration reform.
They've said that, and they're behind immigration reform, but they, they're also brutally enforcing current deportation policies. And it's very important to understand this, Jeremy. For Hispanics, and this is, again, according to the Pew Hispanic Center, on immigration policy, deportation relief is seen as more important than a pathway to citizenship. Everyone understands that with immigration reform, they might be able to, forget about deportations and to have a legal status. But at this point, they don't really care about becoming citizens. They want to be able to work. They want to be able to contribute and not live in fear.
Enrique, do you agree with the term deporter-in-chief that's been used to describe President Obama?
Well, deporter-in-chief or champion-in-chief of immigration reform, it's all rhetoric, and it's not going to help solve the lives of 11 million undocumented immigrants who are already here, Jeremy. That's the truth. I believe that President Obama has the opportunity to fix things for Hispanics in terms of deportations, but it's also a reality that no matter what, his reputation has been tarnished because of deportations.
Enrique Acevedo is an anchor with Univision News. Enrique, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is trying to decide whether to approve the powerful new painkiller Mox Duo, a combination of morphine and oxycodone that backers say will be valuable to people in intense pain, but critics say is a drug that can be misused and add to an epidemic of painkiller abuse and overdoses. Today, an FDA advisory committee is holding a day-long hearing. NPR science correspondent Rob Stein is following it in Washington. Rob, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And tell us more about this drug and why people support it.
Right. Mox Duo is a combination of two other drugs that people have probably heard about. One is called morphine and the other one is called oxycodone. And what Mox Duo does is combine those two powerful opioids into one capsule for the first time. And the company that makes this, that developed the drug, says that the idea is that by taking the two drugs together, you could take lower doses of each of them, and that would make it safer and would produce fewer side effects.
And who is it supposed to help the most?
It's really designed for people who need really fast, really strong pain relief, you know, quickly. These are people who have been in accidents like car crashes or industrial accidents where they've broken a bone or something, or maybe people who are recovering from some sort of surgery like a hip replacement or a knee replacement or cancer surgery or back surgery.
Very serious pain.
Yeah, really intense pain that people really need to get relief from quickly, and that up until now, maybe some of these patients have had trouble getting pain relief because they can't take enough of the drugs to really get the relief they need. These drugs can have side effects like nausea, vomiting, terrible itchiness and dizziness, and that limits the amount of these drugs they can take, and so they can't get the pain relief that they need.
Right. You also have breathing problems, which is why people who take too much overdose. They have these suppressed breathing problems, and those are some of the concerns about the drug, but also aren't there concerns that they can be not just overtaken, someone can take too much, but that they can be crushed up and used in ways they weren't intended?
Right. That's the big concern among addiction specialists out there is that they say that this drug would be very easy to abuse, that in the form that the company's applied to get approved, it could easily be crushed, which would make it easy to snort, easy to maybe inject, and that they're worried that, you know, we already have this epidemic of prescription painkiller abuse and misuse in this country, that millions of people are addicted and thousands are dying from overdoses, that this would just make it worse. It would just provide another drug that would be really easy to abuse and misuse.
Yeah. Well, Rob, it's interesting. Here in Massachusetts, there's been a debate over another drug that our governor tried to ban because of the concern about painkillers. And I spoke anecdotally to a pharmacist who said, don't just ban something on a state level. The feds need to require what they required of oxycodone when that powerful painkiller first came out. Explain what has had to happen in the past to these drugs with the fear that they would be misused.
Yeah, there's been a big push to try to make these drugs a lot harder to abuse, to create what they call tamper-resistant formulations of these medications. And the company is well aware of this and knows about the concerns. And so they're saying two things. One is that if they get approval, they will have a very detailed system in place to prevent abuse in the first place and spot any indications that this drug is being misused. And also they say they're working on a tamper-resistant formulation of Mox Duo that would make it harder to crush and snort and inject. But that's not the version that's not ready yet, and that's not the version that they've applied to get approved.
So meanwhile, this FDA advisory committee, what are they expected to do today? What's the timeline?
Yeah, so they spent this morning, they heard from the company. The company made its case that the drug works, that it's effective, and that it has fewer side effects and is safer. Then they just heard from the FDA's own experts reviewed all the evidence, and they raised some serious questions. They really did question whether the company had proved its case, whether the drug really is more effective and is safer.
I expected a vote later this afternoon. We'll hear what happens.
Yeah, that's right.
Rob Stein, NPR science correspondent. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Lake Mead is the largest reservoir in the United States. It straddles Nevada and Arizona and draws water from the Colorado River and from snowmelt. It's also where you'll find the Hoover Dam. But right now, it's at its lowest levels in generations, which is particularly problematic for Las Vegas, which gets 90% of its water supply from Lake Mead. Joining us now from Las Vegas is Adam Burke, news director for Nevada Public Radio, KNPR. Hi, Adam.
Howdy, Jeremy.
Well, how low is Lake Mead right now?
Lake Mead reached an historic high in the late 90s, and since then, it's dropped nearly 100 feet. So the LA Times recently reported that the upper intake valve that draws water from the reservoir to Las Vegas is a little less than 50 feet above that upper intake pipe. So it's a lot lower than it used to be, but you can see the decline of the reservoir when you go there, or the people who fly over into Las Vegas see this giant bathtub ring around the edge of the lake where the water used to be.
You've seen it, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, and you can't miss the bathtub ring. You can see it from a distance.
Now, what kind of a difference does that make at this point for Las Vegas, if any? Are people in Las Vegas changing their water consumption habits because of this?
I think that's still a relatively small fringe of people who are doing kind of extreme things. Like, I know a few people who catch their rinse water from doing their dishes and they'll dump it into their gardens and things like that. But for the most part, people, they pay for water as it comes to them, and water is relatively inexpensive here still. So, you know, a lot of people haven't changed their habits. But the Water Authority, which is the local agency that governs water use in Southern Nevada, has pushed for certain measures and tried to encourage people to retire their lawns and go to xeriscaping. And, you know, that's had mixed results. But according to the LA Times report, 70% of the water use here is growing grass. So there's a long way to go, evidently.
Yeah, which may surprise a lot of people, because if you drive around Las Vegas, people don't have yards in a lot of places. They have just rocks in front of their house, which a lot of water experts say is the right thing to do in a place where there's not a lot of rain. But 70%, as you say, of this water is being used for things like golf courses and lawns and parks.
That's right. So, you know, as climate change continues to grip the region and drought persists, we'll have to make some tough choices about whether those golf courses are the right thing to do. On the one hand, tourists love to play golf, and we love tourists here in Las Vegas, so we may not have as much wiggle room there as conservationists would like. On the other hand, if the cost of water goes up, or if the states start suing one another over the use of the Colorado River, it may become a prohibitively expensive thing to do to grow grass.
Well, and we should say that if you look at Las Vegas water use in general, it has actually come down on a per capita basis over the last several decades, but the population has gone up. And if you think about the strip in Las Vegas where all those hotel casinos are, some of them with these incredible water features in front of them, a lot of that is recycled water and is actually very smartly used. We spoke with Charles Fishman about this. He's the author of the book, The Big Thirst, and here's what he had to say about Las Vegas's water use.
Las Vegas is one of the most water-smart cities in the country, and even one of the most water-smart in the world. They have no choice. The amount of water they could take from the huge reservoir Lake Mead was set back in the 1930s, and although the city is 10 times, even 100 times the size it was then, they don't get any new water. So they have to figure out how to use the very limited water they've got smartly, or they'd have to stop growing.
Adam Burke, square that for us. How does it work out that Las Vegas is a very smart city when it comes to water, and also spending 70% of its water on golf courses and stuff?
Well, I mean, officials like to point to the efficiency of the Las Vegas Strip. I mean, you mentioned it yourself. The fountains that we see when we walk the Las Vegas Strip are a little bit of an illusion. They come from recycled water. The Water Authority likes to say that the Strip uses 3% of the region's water and accounts for 70% of the economy. So in that sense, it's efficient. On the other hand, there obviously is some belt tightening that can and probably should be done, as the reservoir, Lake Mead, and the Colorado River as a water resource dwindles.
Well, let's talk about some of the other options, and one of them is a pipeline.
That's right. 90% of our water comes from the Colorado River, and so as water officials look for other options, there are only a few available. There is this contingency plan in the works, a multi-billion-dollar pipeline project that would bring in groundwater from the Great Basin to the north. it apparently over decades would cost some $15 billion. But right now, that project is stuck in court battles with a coalition of opponents. Still, in January, when we talked to John Ensminger, the head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, he told us that that's the authority's only plan B.
Is there any talk of slowing the development of Las Vegas, which has seen in recent years, especially before the recession, big population increases?
So that's the big question, right? What happens to sprawl? What happens to growth in a city that's been rooted in that for a few decades now? And we were the fastest growing city in America in the early aughts. Well, the cost of water has at least something to do with it. So if the cost of water goes up, it'll be more difficult to build more homes and pull more people here. But right now, the cost of water is relatively low because our infrastructure is new. So people pay for what they can get, right? If water's cheap, it doesn't really seem prohibitively expensive to build more houses.
And what about individuals? When you walk around the streets of Las Vegas and talk to people, are they talking about the need to conserve just on an individual level, to turn off the faucet as soon as possible when they're done using it, or to take shorter showers?
I was at a party, actually, a few weekends ago, an evening party. It was in a backyard, and there was a bunch of grass and picnic tables and these big mulberry trees. And we were all kind of gathered talking. And the people on either side of me were arguing about water use. And the guy who owned the house loved his lawn, and he loved how it felt to walk out his back door and have this, you know, cool environment, this little oasis that he could enjoy every evening. And the woman on the right was telling him he had to wrap it up and put in xeriscaping. And they're old friends, and I think it was an old argument. But I think as the region looks at the cost of water going up and this level of the lake dropping, there'll be some hard choices, and those conversations will become more commonplace.
Adam Burke, news director with Nevada Public Radio, KNPR in Las Vegas. Adam, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
And if you're listening to us on KNPR in Las Vegas, have you cut your water use? Let us know at hereandnow.org. By the way, I'm looking right now at the drought monitor map. Almost 70% of the West is in some kind of drought, about 43% in severe drought, and 4%, mostly in California and Nevada, in exceptional drought. That's the highest level.
A survey from the Cooperative Children's Book Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison found that out of 3,200 books published in 2013, only 93 were about African-American characters, the lowest in two decades. Walter Dean Myers and his son Christopher did not need that survey to know that. Walter is the African-American author and former ambassador for children's literature. His son Christopher is an author and illustrator who says he remembers his dad suggesting a book about wizards or something years ago. Oh, that'll never work, publishers said. There's no market for that. Then, years later, hello, Harry Potter. The two wrote side-by-side op-ed pieces for the New York Times recently on the pitfalls of the market and what Christopher called the apartheid of kids' literature, with characters of color limited to the townships of occasional historical books on civil rights and slavery. Chris and his father, Walter Dean Myers, both join us from the NPR studios in New York. Chris, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And Walter Dean Myers, welcome back to Here and Now.
All right, thank you.
Christopher, start with you. Have I got this right, that kids seeing themselves in books, someone who looks like them, isn't as much about having a mirror, having their self reflected. It's about having a roadmap.
Absolutely. I feel like there is this thought somehow that children should just want to see themselves, to see their own circumstances. But in fact, these books are used as tools of fantasy. These books are used as ways that kids can make roadmaps for their own lives. And if we don't give them proper roadmaps, where are they going to end up? It's not simply a numbers game. This crisis of diversity in children's books is better named and better understood as a crisis in our country, a literacy gap. When we look at the achievement gap in economic terms, when we look at the achievement gaps in education between low-income communities and their richer counterparts, we see that our country, our nation, is in a deep, deep crisis.
There have been studies saying that if the kids are behind in the third grade, only 20% of those kids ever catch up. What happens, the kids also understand the gaps. They see this wide divergence, and they give up. And so one of the tools we can use to try to bring them back into the mainstream is transmitting values in books. When you go to a book and you see your circumstances, here is a poor child, here is a child who doesn't have breakfast every morning. When they see themselves, they're saying, look, I am valuable. Sometimes when I talk to children and try to give them my good doing talk, oh, you must read a lot, they say they're not interested. They don't have the vocabulary to say, I've given up. But this is what's happening. The kids are actually giving up.
Well, talk more about what happened to you, because if I'm reading your op-ed correctly, things happen in your family, you begin to despair, and part of it was you weren't seeing yourself or this roadmap that we're talking about reflected in the books that you were reading, and you stopped reading, and then this is such a powerful line. In retrospect, you say, you lost the potential person you would become.
I stopped reading. I stopped writing altogether. I just did not see who I could be anymore. I just felt lost.
Dad, do you feel like you gave up in the way that you talk about when you see these children that have given up? Do you feel like that had happened to you?
I felt that it had happened to me quite a lot.
But then you picked up James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues.
It was a shock to me. I did not love the story, but it was about my neighborhood. It was about poor people. And I said to myself, well, who is James Baldwin? And I discovered that he lived only like a half a mile from me in Harlem. It revived me. It gave me permission that I did not know that I needed.
It gave you your roadmap.
It gave me my roadmap.
Yeah.
One of the most disheartening things about the overwhelmingly positive response to Dad and I's piece in the Times is the idea that this is not a new conversation. This is a conversation that has been happening for at least since 1965, when Nancy Larrick wrote an article called The All-White World of Children's Books.
Talk a little more, both of you, about that. You have been told, and we're seeing it in the articles today, that the market doesn't want more books with African-American kids as characters.
The market is not demanding it, but that cannot be our solution, because we're shunting off so many thousands and thousands of children. You have a graduation rate throughout this country, which is obscene. New York City has a terrible graduation rate. And when you break that down to the poor kids, you're getting 50 to 65% of the kids going through the school system not being able to function in America. And we can't say, well, there's no market for them. What we're saying is that there's no need for these kids. And, you know, when I go to the schools and the juvenile prisons and I talk to kids on the streets, they deserve a future.
It's funny, you're saying that you may agree that right now there's not a great demand, but it sounds like it may be because kids and their parents may not even know what they're missing. But Christopher, you say that you don't even believe that because you've been told that white kids won't buy a book with a black kid on the cover, but as you say, white kids buy CDs with black kids on the cover all the time.
Absolutely. As people who deal with fictions, we're very familiar when we see them. And the market
right.
is a fiction, and it's worked on, and we make up our best theories as to what will sell or what won't sell. But in the end, the market is a fiction, and we're constantly being surprised by the market in various other media industries. For example, maybe 15 years ago, I'm not the biggest Tyler Perry fan, but the idea of a Tyler Perry, of a vernacular black cinema, was not commonplace.
Tyler Perry, the producer, the Uber producer with films and TV shows now, to his credit, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. And now you see that he is by himself a cottage industry.
Well, and it strikes me this isn't just about poor kids of color, it's about poor white kids as well.
Exactly.
And changing the children's literature is also about all kids. We're thinking of, there was a recent brouhaha when the book Hunger Games went to the big screen. One of the characters, Rue, is described very purposely by the author as black, of color, and yet when an African-American actress was cast to play Rue, there was this outcry on social media, mostly by white young people saying, why is she black? Why is she black? They couldn't even, in their mind's eye, they'd seen so few black characters in literature, they didn't even pick up that she was black.
Exactly right. I remember Norman Lear came to me and wanted to do The Young Landlords.
One of your books.
One of my books. I was all happy until he says, except we're going to change all the black kids to white kids and move it from Harlem to Greenwich Village.
But the idea is that children's literature, children's media, we are making for our children a picture of the society that they are going to be living in. And if we're making these segregated images, then we can't be surprised when people are outraged when they see images of little black girls in the Hunger Games. In trying to make books that reflect our dreams, our hopes for what our society can be, we don't want to use such a feeble excuse as the market to limit what our society can be. I really don't want my society being dictated by what I think will sell at the local B. Dalton, if there were B. Daltons anymore.
No, and I don't want my grandchildren, hopefully, Chris.
I'm working on it, Dad.
Okay. I don't want my grandchildren to think of themselves only in terms of slavery, the civil rights movement. I want them to have a full range of imaginative literature.
Like the heroic character Rue in Hunger Games.
Yes.
Yeah.
Except that I don't want my children to necessarily have to die at the end. I mean, I'm just not spoiler alert. Sorry for the Hunger Games fans.
Yes. Yeah. Christopher and Walter Dean Myers talking about the lack of people of color in children's literature. We'll link you to their op-eds at hearandnow.org. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.